This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we will visit with Elliot Stonecipher, the pollster from Shreveport. He's been in the Louisiana political game for a long time. In 1987, he aided Buddy Romer in his quest successfully to become governor of Louisiana. Buddy Romer, who was elected at the age of 44, never won another election in our state, or anywhere else for that matter. Is the same fate in the offing for Governor Bobby Jindal, who turns 42 in a few days? We'll talk with Elliot Stonecipher about the legislative session, which is in its final days, and how Governor Jindal has fared and where we go in the next 2.5 years with Bobby Jindal as the state's chief executive. Also, Chelsea Braisted of the NOLA.com news crew on the historic Lincoln Theater in Baton Rouge. Is it going to survive? All this, now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local dial. If you're calling long distance, 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. With less than 80 hours to go in the 2013 regular legislative session, we are visiting with a man who's been around the block a few times in Louisiana politics and has seen a few sessions come and go, Elliot Stonecipher, the noted pollster and demographer from Shreveport. Good morning, Elliot Stonecipher.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's always good to talk to Elliot Stonecipher. And let's start with one of the developments last week. At the end of the week, State Senator Elbert Guillory of Opelousas, a black Democrat, became a Republican. He now brings the number of GOP members in the Senate to 25, one short of a two-thirds level for the state GOP in the upper chamber. And he had some harsh words for the Democratic Party as he parted company with his party at the age of 68. He says their support of dependency over self-reliance, of everything but traditional marriage, of abortion on demand, their policies have encouraged the high teen birth rates, high school dropout rates, high incarceration rates, and very high unemployment rates. Those words from Senator Elbert Guillory. With those kinds of harsh statements, I guess the question is, what took him so long?
It's an excellent question, and as many of us know, he has been, of course, shall we say, helpful to a Republican governor, mightily so, over the past few years. He's kind of drifted back and forth between the two, let's say, sides of the aisle, depending on a lot of different things that were going on. I don't think anybody's taking it, you know, as some huge sign of anything in particular, except that he finally wandered enough times away from his political roots in the Democrat Party that this seemed to be the logical thing to do. Now, whether there was any further encouragement, inducement even, from the governor and his folks for this, I don't know. But, you know, I don't think any of us would be surprised.
Stephen Handwerk, the spokesman for the Louisiana Democratic Party, the executive director, says Guillory is aligning himself with the party that has stood with Governor Bobby Jindal's, quote, failed policies and against working families in Guillory's home base of Acadiana. Handwerk says Republicans have opposed equal pay for women, expansion of Medicaid to cover more of the state's uninsured. And the Democratic Party is not going to take this lightly, and they shouldn't. It's really not a good development for the Democratic Party, is it?
No, it never is. I mean, anytime you see a veteran African-American politician in any deep southern state do this, that is not a good sign. I think in this particular case, there are an awful lot. There's a lot of history that would kind of suggest to us that this is maybe not as serious as any other such defections could be. But the Democrat Party in Louisiana has been kind of filling its sails again with enough wind to actually look like a political party, which in Louisiana it has not for quite some time. As it does that, particularly in its opposition to Governor Jindal, something like this is not anything they needed, and as you say, I think it's going to be very, very clean break, shall we say, this time.
A few years ago on this program, you indicated that the state was still fertile for campaigns from statewide from conservative Democrats. Do you still share that or have that point of view, Elliot?
I do, and I do it because I think there's a simple test. how do we, who probably spend way too much time keeping up with all of this, how would we respond if we found out that, for example, former Governor Blanco was taking a look at the race again this time? Aside from the relative political minutiae of timing and so forth, there would be the question of Katrina. I understand that. If Katrina is off the table, do we see a Democrat like Kathleen Blanco as someone who just has no chance of being governor? I think the answer is no. I think we looked at this very, very specifically when John Breaux was thinking about running in the race when Bobby Jindal was finally elected governor, his second try, of course, in 2007. It seemed compatible then. John Breaux, that is, the conservative Democrat beliefs with where Louisiana is, John Breaux had issues of residency and other things that ultimately disqualified him. But I think at the state level, I think it is very, very foolish to just assume that because of the relative redness we are told of Louisiana that a Democrat cannot be elected. Flip side of all that, Jim, as you well know, is this has to be a conservative Democrat. Mary Landrieu is not a conservative Democrat. I know she would like us to believe that, but I don't think by any objective measure she is. Yet she was reelected, of course, in 2008. I don't know that she'll have that success this time, but that's another benchmark, if you will, for the possibility of Democrats elected statewide. I know how racist this sounds, and you and I have discussed the fact that it is not. African-American Democrats running statewide have not found success in the past, whether it was Cleo Fields or Bill Jefferson. I still think that is too high a hill to climb because that's an electorate that's about 32%, and we know that there are Democrat whites in Louisiana that would vote for an African-American candidate statewide. We've seen it. But it always comes up to about 40%, and I think that's still a ceiling. I don't think we can punch through that one yet.
297-5633, if you'd like to join the chat with Elliot Stonecipher, pollster and demographer from Shreveport, who spends a lot of quality time, of course, in this area on occasion, representing people and analyzing what's going on at the Capitol. The other dust-up last week at the Capitol involved the chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party, Karen Carter Peterson, and the governor. Senator Peterson, who was on this show Friday, opened the week by chiding her colleagues for not supporting Medicaid expansion, and she said that race was a factor in that decision. Do we have her initial comments, Kevin?
Why is that? I have talked to so many members, both in the House and the Senate, and you know what? You ready? You ready what it comes down to? It's not about how many federal dollars we can receive. It's not about that. You ready? It's about race. No, nobody wants to talk about that.
That was Karen Carter Peterson, who followed up after she got pounced verbally by the chair of the Republican Party, Roger Villery, who called on her to apologize. She was on this show Friday and said she wasn't going to apologize.
I've gotten support and heard from supporters, both Republicans and Democrats on the Senate floor that are members, that have said, I know what you said, Karen. I heard what you said. You didn't call anybody a racist. You said that race was a factor in the decision-making of some of the members.
Now, Governor Jindal, who usually doesn't get involved in these kinds of disputes, said Senator Peterson's remarks were, quote, pathetic. What do you think, Elliot Stonecipher? Is this a one-week story, or will it have some transference after the session?
You know, Jim, I think it's an always story in Louisiana, and we're not the only state where it is an always story. I am reminded, however, I want to take this quickly to the national, expand the view to national to understand why so many people, I think, responded poorly to Karen Carter Peterson's comments. Many of us remember not too many years ago, as the Obama administration was new, when Attorney General Eric Holder made some comments in a prepared speech. It was not a speech. I think it was at a university. And he talked about our unwillingness in America to discuss race, and he said he thought we were a nation of cowards. I think the way these comments are made by African-American leaders is many, many times what touches the most sensitive nerve. I know Bobby Jindal was over the top in saying it's pathetic. I think I understand what Karen Carter-Peterson's frustration must be. She's in a state where, as I just described, it'll be virtually impossible in our lifetimes for an African-American to be elected statewide. In that atmosphere, the victory for African-American leaders has been Barack Obama and his administration. At the core of that is, of course, health care, particularly for those who are poor, and those are disproportionately African-American. You have some running room, therefore, if the subject is D.C.-based national policy, President Obama. You don't have any at the state level. Here, the expansion of Medicaid has become this litmus test of everything about this context. Much, much, much has been done in this session to force the governor to do what, in essence, President Obama is asking him to do. He will not. The legislature will not. I don't think the state supports it either. Karen Carter-Peterson's frustration is obvious. I thought she expressed very, very well what I believe she was trying to say, none of which changes the fact that you can talk about the expansion of Medicare, Medicaid, any other social program you want to, without saying directly that you're angry, you're wounded, you're frustrated, and therefore it's about race. You can't do it if you're an African-American leader, and you can't do it if you're a white leader. It's just not the way to go about doing it. So I understand it, but I don't think it was helpful.
Nine Republican governors have reversed course and have accepted the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. Now, most of the Republican governors in the country have not, but Governor Jindal shows no signs of buckling on this in the final days of the session. What do you think of this?
Jim, I'm up here in Shreveport where we are fighting a very, very difficult community-level battle with state and federal agencies still in the wings over the privatization of LSU Hospital and what that does, in fact, to the LSU Med School. In that context, there is a great deal of information circulating about the expansion. And I just got to tell you, the people who are in the hospital business, in and around the hospital business, understand perfectly what Governor Jindal is saying. They tend to come down strongly on his side. Their point being that the expansion is a kind of bait and switch. It is a statement of people's distrust, not just of Washington, but of President Obama. And that is increasing as new issues unveil themselves over the last few weeks. It's not decreasing. On top of that, we have a lot of people here in the healthcare industry who believe that the governor has real cred in this category. I don't, by the way. I do not buy into that. I never have. I don't think that's where his expertise is. He's held a lot of jobs. That was one of the jobs. So I don't agree with that part. If you listen to people whose business this is, they tend to believe that it is a bad deal for any state like ours over time. Now, I don't know how in the world you judge that pre-implementation of Obamacare, because I think that's going to change the world where all this is concerned. But for now, I defer to the people who seem to know about it, and they think the governor's right.
All right, 297-5633. We will go to the phone lines in just a moment for Elliot Stonecipher, the noted demographer and pollster from Shreveport. I started the show today by saying that Governor Romer was elected at the age of 44, and a lot of people, including yours truly, by the way, thought that Buddy Romer might be president someday, and he never won another election. Has Bobby Jindal won his last election?
It certainly looks that way right now. I think it's important for all of us to contemplate how the governor's chances outside the state of Louisiana looked 2 years, 3 years, 4 years ago compared to now, and I would even go further. I would say 1 year ago compared to now. I think the governor has had an extraordinarily bad, politically bad year, and it's not getting better. We'll find out about a special session this summer pretty soon on the budget.
297-5633, back after 90 seconds, and we'll go to the phones with Elliot Stonecipher. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, wherever you are, 877-217-5757. Works as a number to dial our show and talk with Elliot Stonecipher in our remaining time with him. Kevin Gallagher producing, and we go to Veronica on Goodwood. Veronica, good morning. You're on with Elliot Stonecipher.
Hi. We've often spoken of Louisiana in terms of black and white, still do today, but I was wondering if you've noticed either party acknowledging our emerging Hispanic population and the fact that they may be open for either party.
Thanks. All right. Thank you, Veronica. We have a smaller Hispanic population in this state than other southern states, but is it significant enough that it could swing an election, Elliot?
Jim, I don't think so. I understand well what Veronica is saying, and as a demographer, I pay extremely close attention to the fact that you just stated, Jim, that we don't have the size, Hispanic population in Louisiana that other states right next to us, Texas, for example, do. That's about economic competition for certain classifications, certain levels, certain types of jobs. I think it is breaking down pretty quickly, and I think pretty soon in specific areas of the state, the Hispanic population will have a chance to influence elections, maybe even at the state representative level. I don't think more than that for quite some time. By the way, I believe any aspect of growth in the population of Hispanics in Louisiana is net very positive. So I think we're all paying attention.
297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org for Elliot Stonecipher. HB in Denham Springs. Hello, HB.
Good morning. Mr. Stonecipher, I think that most people would agree that the legislature is going to reach some type of an agreement on the budget in this session here. But the question remains, do you think that the governor is going to come back 4, 6, 8 months from now and demand some more budget cuts as he's done in the past, because it's just not going to work? What's your opinion, please, sir? Thank you.
HB, it's a very good question, and we are, of course, paying an awful lot of attention to it as we speak. I think the short answer to your question is, first of all, I think we still have a decent chance at a special session, so I'm not sure it gets resolved. But I do believe we're looking at mid-year cuts again next year if the governor gets the budget that he wants, which basically is the Senate budget. I think the budget reform pieces of what the House is proposing was the best way, not the way we'd all pick, but probably all things considered the best way to not have another round of mid-year cuts in 2013-14. So I think if he passes the budget he likes, if he gets it passed with his favors he's passing around as we talk today, I think we're back next year with more mid-year cuts.
A few moments ago you said the governor had a bad year politically, and the poll numbers indicate that. But he had a bad year in 2003. He was the early favorite, and he ran way ahead in the primary for governor and then lost to Kathleen Blanco, and many thought he would win that race. And he came back. Can he come back again?
Jim, I think the difference is what those of us with a long tenure have learned matters. What he did after 2003, what he did even in 2008 after some pretty rough mistakes politically, especially on the national stage, he had a lot of money in Louisiana for a brief period of time as governor. That was, in fact, I'll use this one again, wind in the sails for him politically. That's gone. As Louisiana didn't have the money, he began having to truly govern. As you truly govern, especially in a second term, we know, it doesn't matter who it is, Bobby Jindal didn't get a pass, it is very difficult to keep your popularity up. As it collapses at home, the national media, who are not on your side, in his case on the left side of that particular divide, they start pounding on you pretty hard, and that starts damaging your chances within your party nationally. It's a normal cycle. It's not new. It's happening to other Republican governors. And I think, frankly, he has been displaced within his party by people like Rubio, and by Ted Cruz, and by a couple of others in the Republican Party who are closer to his age. And frankly, they don't have the baggage that he has at this point. So I don't care if it's Rubio. I don't care which one it is. He's got to fight past them, Jim, at this point. I don't see him doing that.
Well, he has stayed true to his word about no new taxes, although when the sales tax swap was on the table, he was talking about all kinds of new taxes, but it was just talk. He was faced with another choice on that issue this past week and said he would veto a 2-cent per month tax on cell phones to generate money for the hearing impaired. Ultimately, the Senate decided to use general fund money instead to appease the governor. The fact that he stayed true to the Grover Norquist creed, is that going to benefit him?
I don't think so. I think the problem with the way it has been cobbled together by the governor and his people, it looks as though it's just a convenience. It's not a commitment. And there's a big difference between the two. I don't think he's committed the way the Grover Norquist governors and others in government who have signed his pledge have to be committed. Many of them are becoming shakier. I think Bobby Jindal always believes that the people he will ask for a vote don't really see him for what he is and what he does. His beliefs and his practices are those dictated by the moment, and most of how he explains what he's done is spin. There's a relative, therefore, lack of substance, and it comes across the longer he governs. As long as that's the case, I think he has real problems, and he never, ever believed that criticism or adjusted to it. He continues to do it.
877-217-5757 is your number. Kathy in Terra asks you, Elliot, why you think Senator Landrieu is vulnerable when polls right now show her even or a little bit ahead of her presumptive challenger, Bill Cassidy.
First of all, I give Senator Landrieu credit always, always have, with being someone who is an absolute warrior on Election Day. I don't agree with the way she does that on Election Day. There's a lot of money that gets spent in ways that I think is very wrong. I think it's always worked for her, but that doesn't mean that it always will. She has cast in the relatively recent past for President Obama some votes that are going to be very, very difficult even for Senator Landrieu to get past. So I think she's in toughest.
What votes are you talking about?
I think the most important one in context, obviously, is her Affordable Care Act vote, still called the 60th Senate vote. The details surrounding that vote, what she got in return, may well come out during this campaign. That will not be good for her. But regardless of that kind of inside baseball, she has to defend that vote in an election year, next year, when the effects of Obamacare are going to be dramatically being felt by people everywhere in America, including in Louisiana. I think the timing that was so wonderful for her politically in 08 is exactly the same, exactly the opposite in 2014. The worst time in the world for her to have to defend that vote.
Now, you're referring to so-called street money that candidates, particularly Democrats, have used for years in Louisiana and in other states to try to get out the vote. But is there anything sinister about trying to help people to get to the polls to cast a vote? Is there anything wrong with that, Elliot?
It depends on how you do it. And frankly, for those of us who have been at this too long, we know how much of that money in the past has been cash. That is illegal. I don't know how much of it happens in New Orleans today. We do know how much of it happened in the past. When you look at election returns anywhere in America in 2013, 14, or even 2002, when she was first elected, and you see long lists of precincts where turnout was high as registration and the senator's vote was 100%. Let's think about this. You have turnout that is as high as registration, and you have one candidate getting every vote in the precinct. When you see long lists of those, and you're someone who, like me, just doesn't think that kind of stuff is fair, and I'm being polite, you come away from it with a real, real conviction that those street operations have to be stopped. I know they are the bread and butter of the Democrat Party throughout America. I get it. I know it's history. None of that makes it right. And I think we got a real problem talking about ethics in government generally when we know how many people in on that discussion participate in these kinds of Election Day activities.
All right. Well, let's look at some white precincts, which we're talking about Cassidy and Landrieu. There will be precincts that are 98-99% white that Bill Cassidy will get 90% of the votes in. Is that any different?
Well, Bill Cassidy is a Republican, and only in 35-40 years of doing all this, I've never seen street money paid by Republican candidates to voters. I never saw a single campaign in which Republican candidates were literally paying people to get on buses, go vote a sample ballot by number, not by name.
Well, now you're getting into alleged criminality. Is that what you're inferring, Elliot?
Well, certainly in the past it has been criminal, and people have been caught doing it. We don't know how much of the cash is still out there now. A lot of what's gone into changing these practices for the last 15 years or so has been to make candidates who do this give every worker a sheet of paper where the worker has to put a Social Security number on it and identify themselves, and trying to rid the whole process of any kind, any uses of cash. A lot has been done in the last 15 years, no question. The problem is there is way too much of it that is still going on all over the country, but here it goes on still as well. But in direct answer to your question, if other people know of Republican candidates who use cash on Election Day down on the streets with their sleeves rolled up, they'll have to let me know.
Well,
I've certainly never seen it.
When I was covering David Duke back in 90 and 91, when I'd go to these rallies, they'd pass the bucket and gobs of cash would be in that bucket. My guess is that Mr. Duke didn't report all that cash. I don't know it, just like you don't know a lot of things that you believe are happening, and you may be right about, Elliot. And hopefully we haven't lost Elliot on this, but there has been cash on the campaign trail on both sides of the political spectrum, and there's no doubt that this is an issue that will be forthcoming in the race involving Senator Landrieu, who seeks re-election next year. And in 2016, if David Vitter is still a U.S. Senator, no doubt he will face a strong Democratic challenge if he runs, if he's not governor by then. And if he were to lose a governor's race, you would think he would come back and try to win a third term in the U.S. Senate. I was pointing out about the cash that I saw go into buckets that were passed at Duke rallies. I don't think the Democratic Party is exclusive in nefarious activities involving campaigns, Elliot.
Let me answer it this way, Jim. First of all, David Duke, to me, is not a Republican candidate, so I will agree with you completely that David Duke was a criminal. He went to prison for being a criminal. I think that's every bit as bad, and it is a great example of what cash can do to a campaign. Doesn't surprise me in the least that David Duke did it. I don't think any of that changes the fact that within the Democrat Party there has been a real, real dependence on Election Day activities throughout the history since the Voting Rights Act, which any objective person would find very, very, very troubling. I think a lot of it's been cleaned up. I think we all get credit for anything any of us have done in that direction, but it is not over. And I just to disagree with you about Republican candidates likewise using cash. And I'm not in the business of defending Republicans, by the way.
All right. Well,
never will be.
Terry notes that there are efforts in some parts of this country, perhaps in this state, to keep minority voters from participating in elections. That's something that is still an issue, isn't it, in some places?
You know, we have a famous case in Louisiana in the Henson Moore campaign many years ago, where that kind of suppression, I believe, was proven. I don't think there was any doubt. I also think many of us were very, very intrigued, somewhat surprised, to find out how the suppression was done. I think that is in and of itself a problem within the Republican Party of the same size, if you will, of the Election Day problem within the Democrat Party. I think the difference is that there is a completely different character of the practice. I don't see voter suppression by a handful of people as awful, and I think that should be criminal, by the way, as it is, as the same kind of pernicious effect on pure democracy that cash on the streets on election day is. I think they are different, therefore, in how they are applied. If the argument is, are they net very, very bad for each party and for the country? Absolutely. I would not argue with that at all.
297-5633 in our remaining time with Elliot Stonecipher, the well-versed demographer and outspoken politico. Kevin, I can't see who's on the phones here, so can you give me the first caller that we need to go to, and I will impart that information to our distinguished guest. Please, who is first up? It is Joe.
Good morning, Jim.
All right, Joe, you're on with Elliot. Hi, Joe.
Thank you. Elliot, Joe Tregel, how are you, sir?
Hey, Joe, how are you doing?
I'm well. I just want to pick up on what you just said, Elliot. I just find that, you know, you and I have known each other for 100 years and basically generally agree on everything, but I very strongly disagree with what you just said. For example, the activities that were done in Florida by the legislature, by the Republican legislature, to intentionally disenfranchise voters by limiting early voting, by restricting voting hours, resulted in lines that lasted 6 or 8 hours. That is just as un-American as anything that might go on in any of the other parties. And I think that that needs to come to light and needs to be brought to stop.
Elliot?
And Joe, I appreciate your comments, and yes, I appreciate our friendship as well. And for the listeners who don't know, Joe has certainly been on the front lines of election activity in Louisiana for decades, so this is a subject near and dear to both of us. You may not have heard, Joe, while we were being connected, I don't see voter suppression as any less damaging to the Republic, frankly, as any other kind of practice on Election Day. I do believe the most egregious violations of law on Election Day, historically and still, are when cash changes hands between candidates who go to elected officials who are African American, and those candidates give those elected officials tons of money, some of it still cash, and those elected officials then turn out on Election Day a whole lot of voters that would not have been turned out without that specific illegality. So I think probably what we're really saying is I have had to deal in my personal career with far more of the damage of Election Day money on the streets than I have with voter suppression. So it's a little more personal to me, but I certainly agree with your basic premise, of course.
All right, hold tight, and Joe is on the line, wants to interject with Elliot Stonecipher, and we will allow him to do so. And Elliot is gracious enough to stay with us for a bit longer. We'll also hear from Chelsea Braisted of the NOLA.com reporting staff on the future of the historic Lincoln Theater in Baton Rouge. All this when we return after this 90-second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. And Elliot Stonecipher has opened a proverbial can of worms here regarding campaigns and how they're financed in Louisiana and how some of the actions on the campaign trail may not be the most altruistic. Joe Tregel, you were absorbing Elliot's response to your response. What's your take on whether we have an issue regarding both parties involving campaign activities?
Well, I think, Jim, first of all, Elliot is absolutely on the money about the problem in Louisiana. It is an epidemic. It has been a problem since day one, and it continues to be a problem. There's no doubt about that, and it needs to be addressed, and the people need to be prosecuted who violate the current law. But number two, the efforts by the Republican Party in Florida, in Ohio, and all across this nation to suppress voter turnout of the African-American community and many other communities is something that basically deserves just as much condemnation as what goes on here in Louisiana.
All right. Thank you, Joe. Elliot?
I do not disagree. I just was asked in the context of Mary Landrieu, so my comments were, of course, much more in the context of Louisiana. than Florida or Ohio, but I agree completely. And again, I'd like to stress, I don't spend 5 minutes of my time ever defending the Republican Party and anything that party does in terms of voter suppression is just one more way that it holds itself down.
Mariba in Bro Bridge. Mariba, you're on with with Elliot Stonecipher. Hi, Mariba.
Good morning, Jim and Elliot. I just wanted to encourage Elliot to take a look at the campaign of Charles Bustani, the most recent campaign of Charles Bustani, and the money he directly and indirectly put on the street in the context of that campaign. While I would agree that this is an issue that has been more pronounced historically with some Democratic candidates, I think the recent Bustani campaign is a sign that this is becoming a bipartisan phenomenon, and we're going to see more and more of that kind of activity from Republican candidates.
Elliot?
I appreciate very much the tip. I have not looked at that campaign. I instinctively believe that what the caller is saying is true. I believe it is out of hand, and Jim, I'd like to mention, for any of your listeners who'd care to look it up, just search up the Hobbs Act. It is a federal law, long on the books, that simply and treats as a criminal violation any elected official using their job to make personal money. That's what happens on Election Day. It is not enforced, never has been, and that has gotten out of hand in Louisiana. And I promise you, I'm not going to find it any less terrible when Republicans do it than when Democrats do. And I do believe, Jim, I think we're about to go through a new wave of it at about the time that we thought maybe it was dying off.
Karen in Ascension Parish says, is Elliot suggesting that Senator Landrieu is a criminal?
No, I'm not specifically suggesting that Senator Landrieu is a criminal. I believe there have been criminal acts in those campaigns over long periods of time, which the senator should have made very, very sure were referred to appropriate legal authority. I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt and say that she is not the person who designed and implemented those violations. But I do believe that she understands very, very well what's in the Hobbs Act, and that she is the appropriate person to make very, very sure that those laws are not broken.
Now, in most cases, and it's not all, and President Obama has certainly shown a capacity to raise historically high amounts of money in running twice for the presidency, but in most elections, Republicans edge Democrats in money raised, and I think it's easy to see why, because of the people who are fond of the Republican Party tend to be those who have more money. So is there anything inherently wrong with the advantage that Republicans generally have when it comes to raising money, or should we have public financing of campaigns where everybody would be playing on an equal field?
I think the Supreme Court has pretty much told those of us who think that kind of reform is long overdue that we're not going to see it. And I would say this, too. I think in the last 20 years, we've turned the political system in America over to a group I call professional partisans. That means people who make a lot of money, huge amounts of money, acting as though it is their heart and soul that leads that person to a Republican candidate or a Democrat candidate. They don't care who the candidate is. They don't care what the party is. They don't care who believes what. They are there to manipulate voters and the system and the fundraising to make money for themselves. Once we went to that, I think a whole lot of the remedies that you and I would have discussed for the past 35 years went out the door. And I believe Supreme Court rulings that have followed the growth of that phenomenon have, in essence, sanctioned it or have, in essence, supported it. And that's just, I don't know how we get past that. In the meantime, I don't think the advantage Republican candidates used to always have even exists anymore. I think with professional partisans, there will always be obscene amounts of money for both parties, pretty much in equal measure.
Well, Elliot, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and let's do it again soon. Thank you, my
friend.
Thank
you very much, Jim.
Bye-bye. And we're joined in studio by Chelsea Braisted of the NOLA.com reporting force, and good morning to you, Chelsea.
Morning, Jim.
Well, it's an interesting time and for newspapers.
That
and,
it is.
And websites.
Absolutely.
For Louisiana news outlets. And Chelsea has a story that is now in the new NOLA.com print publication in Baton Rouge. In fact, it's the cover story, Saving the Lincoln. And the Lincoln is the Lincoln Theater, which was opened in 1956. And it is a place that many in our community may not realize it has historical consequence. Louis Armstrong played at the Lincoln, the Four Tops, Otis Redding, James Brown, Nat King Cole, and Martin Luther King Jr. met with Baton Rouge's black leaders there after the 1953 bus boycott. And it is in disarray, disrepair, and there have been efforts to refurbish it. And those efforts to this point have not proved successful. So where does it stand right now?
Well, right now, basically, the Louisiana Black History Hall of Fame, Board of Directors is effectively trying to, you know, refurbish, this theater. They're in phase one right now. They're using an EPA grant with about $190,000 to basically just stabilize the theater. That's effectively all the money they really have right now, and what they're looking to do is just mitigate any further damage, take out current environmental hazards. I believe there's a few asbestos panels. There's been a lot of water damage thanks to some other damage to the roof, so it's basically they're just looking to mitigate what they can now before they, you know, look toward phase two and three, which would basically be renovate and expand mm-hmm. the space.
Well, the building stands at the corner of Myrtle Walk and South 13th Street in Old South Baton Rouge, and for those who are consumed with trying to do something with the City Park Golf Course, it's about a six-minute walk from the Lincoln Theater to the City Park Golf Course. I know. I live in that area. I walk the area, and I do walk past the Lincoln on a regular basis, and it's kind of sad that this historic gym has been largely neglected, is not getting the attention of something like the City Park Golf Course, and yet it has as much historical consequence as almost any building in this city.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm actually, you know, pretty much in the same neighborhood as well, and I didn't even know it was there until I had to cover this story. But, you know, going by, it's a pretty beautiful building, you know, for all of the damage it's sustained so far. So it would be nice to see something really, really interesting happen with it, especially in that neighborhood in the city.
Well, I used to drive by there on Myrtle Walk when I was in college at LSU, and I would see movies like Superfly. I didn't actually go see them, and I wish I had, but on the marquee, Superfly and Kung Fu and Shaft, and there would be large crowds outside at that time. But it's been a long time. How long has it been pretty much
dead
on arrival?
Yeah, it's been closed. It's closed once before, but at this point it closed last in 2006. Ted Jemison Jr. Owned the property, mm-hmm. and after his mother passed away, he really wasn't able to maintain the theater anymore, especially with, you know, the lack of crowds at the time. They weren't getting any first-run movies or anything by then. So,
well, about 3 years ago, Chelsea points out that the LBHHF, then that stands for
the Louisiana Black History Hall of Fame,
tried to raise enough money to renovate the theater, but the dollars did not come forth as anticipated. And in 2009, the Louisiana Black History Hall of Fame bought the building for $345,000, joined forces with Baton Rouge's Redevelopment Authority with the aim of reopening the facility with a renovated theater and a space for the Hall of Fame. Based on what you've seen to this point, is that going to be a reality, or is this all talk?
Well, you know, it's really hard to tell. When I was at the second fundraising kickoff, it was the Friday before Memorial Day. When I was inside, they had, you know, maybe 30 people show up. Granted, it wasn't the best time to maybe throw that kind of shindig. But, I mean, as soon as I walked outside to take some photos for the publication, I had two separate people, you know, roll up to me on a bicycle or drive by in their car and stop and ask me, oh, are you one of the people that's helping to, you know, to renovate mm-hmm. the theater? I have such great memories. I used to work there. I was a janitor. I did this. And I mean, it was really interesting to see that kind of warmth from the community, yet it didn't seem like there were many people inside at the front fundraiser. So
297-5633. So we don't know. But right now, the seat cushions and the wall coverings have water damage. And Chelsea, you went inside, didn't you?
I did not go inside, but I was able to see some photos from people mm-hmm. who had gone inside. And I mean, mm-hmm. and from everything that they told me, you know, there's a lot that needs to be replaced and there's a lot that needs to be done to renovate. Mm-hmm. You know, but.
Well, Carolyn Bennett and the people at the Foundation for Historical Louisiana have done a great job of publicizing the plight of the Lincoln Theater and of the Huey P. Long Pool at LSU. But so far, those two jewels in the city are neglected, and let's face it, they're facing extinction. Johnny P. downtown. Johnny, you're on the air with Chelsea.
Yeah, join the conversation. There's also the Lincoln Hotel on Eddie Robinson Boulevard at the corner of Government. That used to house all of the great artists that played at the Temple Roof and also in the Lincoln Theater. I'm wondering why, you know, we have so many historical buildings that are not being given more attention instead of trying to pave some green space and put a parking lot on the City Park golf course. I'll listen up here.
That's a good point. They're probably bigger and more important battles to fight than the one at City Park, and the Lincoln would be a good place to start. The Baton Rouge Area Foundation sprang into action and put the Capitol House Hotel back on the map after 22 years of it being shut down. Perhaps BRAF can get involved with the Lincoln. There are some ways to make this happen, but it's going to take money and it's going to take community support.
Absolutely. You know, I think the money is out there. And one of the things that, you know, is different about this round of fundraising attempt is they actually did bring in a consultant for that, Savitri Wilson. She'll be on board, you know, basically as one person dedicated to bringing the dollars in. So we'll
$11 million is what they're looking for, right? That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. But, I mean, in the scheme of things, it's kind of chump change when you consider how much it would cost to you know, build a brand new state-of-the-art mm-hmm. theater, something like that for the city.
And I must say, for those who are afraid to walk in that neighborhood, I walk in it day and night, and I have never had a problem. But there are people who just don't want to go in that neighborhood.
Right. The neighborhood obviously doesn't have the best reputation, but it's a... There are a lot of, you know, really unique places down there. It's right across the street from the Museum of Public Art, which I also discovered for the first time when I was down there.
Well, it's a place that is worthy of preservation. And the offices for attorneys Johnny Jones and Bruce Bell, as you point out in your story, who worked for the United Defense League in the Baton Rouge Post, the city's African-American newspaper, were also located at the Lincoln back when it first opened. So It's a historic gym. The last iteration, it had a barbershop, right? And what else was in there other than the theater?
Previously, they also, of course, lastly, they had the barbershop, but they also previously had the offices you mentioned and a pharmacy, I believe, and a life insurance office. I mean, it's been a hub for the African-American community in Baton Rouge throughout the civil rights era.
And it really is remarkable how close it is to some other landmarks. It's less than a mile from the LSU Lakes. It's not far from the LSU campus. And it's literally a few blocks away from City Park. And yet, as you said, I would bet that most people in this city have never driven by the Lincoln Theater, or certainly never walked by there. I would encourage them to do so.
Yeah, it's a wonderful space, and you know, I think it would be, you know, a definite boon to the community if we were able to manage something with that.
Well, the initial goal was to renovate the building, create additional back of house space, purchase property for a small park, and then this idea, I think it's a great idea for a Hall of Fame, ensued, and it would probably bring a lot of foot traffic and more activity to that area if it happened.
Oh, certainly. And at this point now, they've basically taken those goals and broken them down into the three phases. So like I said, phase one is just, you know, stabilizing the building. And then phase two would be renovating, and three would be all of the additions.
Well, since covering it, Chelsea, a year from now, when we look back, do you think we'll be talking about the same issues, or will we see some signs of life for the Lincoln?
You know, I would hope that we can see some signs of life. I think it's a great, like I said, great gem for the community, and hopefully we can see something good come out of it.
Let us hope so. And so maybe we ought to take the focus off City Park and put it on the Lincoln. And I would encourage those who are in favor of turning City Park into a different kind of place to take a walk down Myrtle Walk and see the Lincoln Theater. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Inkster. We thank you for listening. Back tomorrow with Mayor President Kip Holden. Until then, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.